Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, Boston. Good afternoon, America. Chuck Morse, host of Chuck Morse Speaks, Monday through Friday, 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You're welcome to join the conversation. 347-327-9849 is the number, 347-327-9849. Joining us this afternoon is Deacon Mike Iwanowicz from Our Lady of Sorrows Roman Catholic Church in Sharon. Mike, how are you?
I'm just fine, doing well in this crisp January day, a little bit of snow, but not what they expected. So, but here we are in Boston. It's January.
Exactly, but I think much of the rest of the northern tier of the country is in much worse shape than us.
Oh, sure.
I understand it's a huge snap of cold weather thundering across the northern plains, as it were. And, Mike, the program is temporarily abbreviated from 2 to 1 hour only because I've become so busy with the podcast interviews I'm conducting over at Unregular Radio and also promoting my new book, which is now available online,
okay.
That being at Amazon Kindle, which is The Monkey Trial.
Great.
I discovered that... And this is a little business note for you authors out there. I discovered that rather than continue to wait for a publisher and for my literary agent to find a publisher for my book, I could have it carried by Amazon Kindle at no charge to me. Basically, you sign up for an account at Amazon Kindle, you create the book, you create the graphic yourself, and you download it onto Amazon Kindle, and now it's available for the public to buy as an Amazon Kindle. And not only that, but just as a business arrangement, it's a very favorable one to the author because you get 70% of the proceeds, and Amazon gets 30%, which is not only the opposite of what you get with a published book, but better than that because your book is published as a traditional hardcover book. You might get 5% if you're lucky.
Right.
And usually people charge between $2 and $5 or $6 for an Amazon Kindle book. I'm charging $3.75, which I think is a moderately priced book. And I know that, Mike, you're a fan of Kindle. Is that
right?
Oh,
yes. That's correct. I do a lot of reading on my Kindle, and it's a great device. And it's a great thing for people to have easy and quick access, economics on one side, but just the whole prospect for me to download a Kindle and within half a minute or so I'm reading it. And over the course of, let's say, 3 years that I've had the Kindle, you know, with about 100 or so books, and I can carry it with me. I'm sitting down having a coffee at my favorite place, and I say, gee, I want to go back and reread a chapter of whatever's book, and it's just like, there you are. You don't have to carry around 100 books in your back.
Right, and I think it's also easy on the eye. It's not the glaring. It's actually created by, I understand, a student at MIT created the technology that made it very easy to look at the Kindle for long periods of time.
And they keep improving. They have different models, too. The one I bought at a Kindle about 3 years ago, you know, one of the first models. And the latest one I have now is even, like, unbelievably clear. And it's terrific. I find myself reading faster, in a sense, rather than sitting down with a book. And I don't know why. Maybe it's psychologically, but you just tap the thing and you go to the next page and... Anyway, you can be really intensely focused.
Right, and I think that there's probably an estimated nearing 1 billion people around the world who have Kindle now. And to my way of thinking, it's probably the way of the future. I personally don't like the idea of seeing the good old-fashioned hardcover book go by the wayside. I mean, I love books. I have thousands of books. But I think that, you know, reality tells me that books are now becoming electronic just like everything else, just like, you know, our own radio show here, which is an internet radio program at CyberStation USA Radio Network. And which, by the way, reminds me, we should introduce my carrying station, CyberStation USA Radio Network, along with our affiliate stations, WWPR-AM in Tampa Bay, Florida, and KSKQ-FM Ashland, Oregon, and, of course, Blog Talk Radio. This is Chuck Morse Speaks, your host, Chuck Morse, Monday through Friday, 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Michael Wanowitz is here as my co-host on Tuesday. We talk faith and its intersection with politics. Mike, did you have an opportunity to listen to the president's inaugural address yesterday?
I did not listen to it. I read it online and so forth, and listened to some of looked at some of the comments on the speech itself. I guess my quick reaction would be is that, you know, it's a very flowery in one sense. It was a great turn of phrase. I mean, whoever wrote the text did a pretty good job in terms of putting things down in crisp English and all of that. Nothing, you know, to be put down as a classic necessarily. But I think he just covered so many of the very liberal progressive ideas. And for those of people who like that, they applauded, I think, you know, kind of considerably. But as I said to myself later on, words, words, and more words.
Well, you know, I also didn't actually see it. I read the text today, as you did, on the NPR site. I don't know if they carried the entire text, the full transcript. But from what I read, I thought it was a very good speech. I mean, it seemed like he quoted the most salient passages from the Declaration of Independence, which he then went on to interpret in I think, a rather left way, a socialistic way. But nevertheless, he quoted it, and he also gave the credit to the Almighty for our rights. And that's almost a border on prayer. So, you know, I thought it was good. I mean, given who President Obama is and given his constituency, I thought it was a fairly balanced and rather down-the-middle type speech. I did not like his reference to collectivism. I mean, I don't think there's any place for that in American society. You know, we are a social people. We tend to work together on various things in a voluntary way, but when the government starts talking about collectivism, it makes me nervous. I think that for the most part, it was pretty solid. And you know, it was I didn't actually see it, so I didn't feel the same emotion that I might have seen if I had seen him deliver it. At least I haven't had a chance to yet. But I know that some people on the right are all twisted out of shape over it. They really shouldn't be. You know, Barack Obama was elected, for better or for worse. He, whether or not, putting aside the question of voter fraud and all that stuff, he did receive the majority of the vote, and he was elected president. So, you know, it's time to honor that, you know, to not necessarily, while we may not necessarily revere the man who is holding the office, we revere the office. And we revere the continuity of American, you know, the American presidency and American governance and in a peaceful way. So to my way of thinking, it's a great celebration.
Well, it's fitting, too, in one sense, given the calendar and the fact that we as a country also yesterday celebrated a day honoring and remembering Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and his great contribution to, again, hoping for equality, the kind of phrases that President Obama used, again, were in direct reference to the mission and the vision that Dr. King had and lived for and died for.
That's right. Although I even would go so far as to suggest that Dr. King's message often is dependent upon who you are and what vantage point that you look at it. On the one hand, the late great Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a Christian minister. He was a Republican. he was a part of a movement that was very well versed in and steeped in the Bible. He made constant biblical references, including his most famous and last speech, where he said that he had been to the mountaintop. That was a reference to Moses.
Right. Right.
He may not get there. I mean, Moses did not enter the Promised Land, but he was sure that his people would get to the Promised Land. I mean, it was very inspiring and very well steeped in the traditions of our Judeo-Christian faith and ethos. I had recently on this program David Pakman, who is a very nice young man. He's very, very liberal, and he's doing a program out in Western Mass. And he said, well, he doesn't think that people of faith should be involved in public life because, you know, it gets into questions of the separation of church and state, and that if they're animated by faith, they're too dogmatic, he tells me, as if somehow, you know, the left isn't dogmatic, which is another topic. But, you know, he wanted to see people tone down their faith, and I pointed out to him that that one of the great political figures of our modern times was Martin Luther King, and he was a minister, and his entire mission was really at least partially animated by his faith, or at least his public expression of his faith. We'll say that. We should remind ourselves of that, and I think the same thing is true of Barack Obama. He prays, he begs, you know, may God bless this country. And it's kind of a good counter to those who feel that for whatever reason they claim or whatever reason is in their hearts that people of faith should be silenced in our public life.
Well, I agree. I mean, so many times people look at President Lincoln and indicate the great, again, I'll use that word, mission that Lincoln had involved in the Civil War and trying to find peace there and the Emancipation Proclamation and all that went with what we call the great contributions to American society for Abraham Lincoln. And yet in his Thanksgiving orations and other speeches, certainly his faith, again, just as you indicate with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., was the bulwark of his public policy from my perspective. And so many people, whether it be Eisenhower, whether it be Roosevelt, which somehow people in a public position of authority and leadership do come to what they are doing based upon some principle of faith.
Absolutely. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that we share the exact same denomination of faith. But, yes, there is a long American tradition of belief in something greater than government, greater than the state as the source of all rights. And Barack Obama mentioned this in his inaugural. He said, quote, that while freedom is a gift from God, it must be secured by his people here on earth. And I think that's very true. You know, I mean, it is a gift from God. It is something that's inherent. It's something that we understand from an early age. I mean, St. Augustine wrote in his Confessions that he believed in God and understood the existence of God as a baby.
Right.
It's something that I think is inherent to the human being, this understanding that there is a, you know, as the Hebrew National commercial says, that we answer to a higher authority. Remember those commercials?
Oh, yes. Right. Well, that's right. And, you know, quoting Augustine, but also St. Paul, you know, says we have faith, but faith without works is incomplete. And what that means is that we have, as Obama rightly said, we have a gift from God, but we have the obligation to move with it, not just to observe it, but to be a participant in trying to work towards these goals of equality and these goals of fundamental freedom and all of that.
Absolutely. And although we may disagree with perhaps what I think is President Obama's understanding and interpretation of what that means, the concept is still there. And I think what inspires the United States is very much the very quote that he mentions in the first part of his speech, the famous quote right out of the Declaration of Independence, the most salient, the most central quote, which is that we all are created equal and we're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. In other words, that I think it's that ethos that really separated the American culture, the American government, the American social system from everything that had ever preceded before it or during the time. Where in Europe, I think they were still very much, and certainly in the rest of the world, they were still very much animated by the concept of the divine right of kings.
Right.
And that, I think, eventually translated in modern times, what I consider a very regressive secular movement that worships the state. The American idea was that it is the Creator that it has endowed rights, not the state. That it is a Creator that we look to, something outside of the state, something that can't be manipulated by people, something that is inalienable, it's inherent, it's natural, it's something that simply, in a sense, the human being's job is to identify what that is and live by it, and that we were fully formed, in a sense. We're not, well, this is another topic, but and this gets into my Kindle, but we're not evolving creatures. We were formed in the very beginning, and as we gain knowledge of how the workings of the world and what God created, we can establish more of the type of system that we thrive in best, which is one that is free, one that leaves us to our own devices to be who we are, both good and bad.
What reminds me too, and I think that whoever, again, I'm thinking that somebody crafted the words in the speech, but for Obama, looking and saying, probably identifying an agenda and set of principles, but again, quoting from our beginnings, that all are created equal, I think immediately in my own mind of Scripture, which would be Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, and when God said, "Let us create man in our image, male and female, he created them." And I think that, to me, is the origin of all the kinds of things that we can say, as Obama indicated in his inaugural address, that we have a gift from God.
Well, yes, and that's the basic theme of my book, The Monkey Trial, which is that we were created in the image of God, and that concept was also codified into our Declaration of Independence when Jefferson wrote that all men are created equal. That means if we're created equal, we're not at different rungs of the evolutionary ladder. We all, are de facto equal. You know, we may be different, but we're equal. We're equal under the law. We're equal in fact. And to my way of thinking, that's something that is definitely a gift from the Torah. It's a gift of understanding from, in my opinion, personally, because of my faith, it's from God. But it runs contrary to our modern ethos. Now, Obama also, you have to understand or you have to speculate in terms of what he really means when he makes comments through his speech, as opposed to what it says on the face of it, which is very good. And I'll give you a couple of examples, if I might. He says, quote, "Together we determined that a modern economy requires railroads and highways to speed traffic and commerce, schools and colleges to train our workers." Now, from the more conservative standpoint, or I should say from the more traditionally Republican standpoint, that's good. That is the Hamiltonian idea of building a national infrastructure, building national schools as a way to sort of bind the nation together and to create freedom, to develop an educated class, to develop means of transportation and all of that, and to develop free commerce. and free markets through in a sense the development of the nation economically, culturally, and politically. And you know, that's the Whig idea. I mean, I wrote a book about that, the Whig Manifesto. And my new book, which will be coming out in a couple of weeks, deals with the Republican Party today, and it suggests that we get back to those roots and reassert ourselves over these issues that have been usurped, I would contend, by the left. Because what Obama really means by that is not necessarily building our infrastructure and improving our education as we know it, in a sense, to make us freer and to do so in a way that that is cost-effective. What it sort of means is let's raise taxes and let's increase the deficit so we could put more of my friends on the payroll and we can create bigger bureaucracies that are going to be more involved in the nanny state, you know, more control over commerce, more control over education, you know, more public control of the means of production. That's maybe I'm being cynical here, but I think that's what he means. I think that evidence suggests that, given the look at how they spent the stimulus money, so-called, in the first term, which was pretty much on corporate friends and on maintaining the big size of government. Anyway, so we have that issue. We're going to take a brief break. You're listening to Chuck Moore Speaks. Michael Wanowicz is my guest. Please stay tuned. Back to the phones are ringing off the hook here. Michael Wanowicz is my guest, Chuck Morse, Monday through Friday, 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You're welcome to join the broadcast, 347-327-9849, 347-327-9849. We're talking about President Obama's second inaugural address. Mike, I mean, we can look at this and take a look at the words on the paper, or the words that were spoken, which were excellent if we view them that way. But then when you take a look at the messenger and you take a look at sort of the reality of it, it's not quite what it seems. President Obama says, quote, "Together we discovered that a free market only thrives when there are rules to ensure competition and fair play. Together we resolved that a great nation must care for the vulnerable and protect its people from life's worst hazards and misfortunes." Now, as far as the comment about the free market, you know, of course you have to have rules. I mean, I think, again, that's an old Whig idea. That's a Republican idea that Republicans need to reassert. And then, in fact, Mitt Romney did say that during one of the debates. No one is suggesting that there's no such thing as an unfettered free market. I mean, that's about as false an idea as communism is. The government is there to protect people. It's to protect industry, in a sense, by making rules of the game. In a sense, it's like a football game. You know, you set the rules, and then once those rules are in place, you let the players go and let them compete, as long as they don't do like the Baltimore Ravens, which is beat up the other team and hurt them and send the thugs to break their knees.
Right.
Nevertheless, we could talk about that separately. You know, you set the rules, and then you let them go. I mean, that's the whole basis of the free market. But I think that what Obama is implying there is he wants more government regulation. He wants heavier government hand in it, in more areas. And it's kind of one of these vague statements. When you take a look at it in the context he means it, that is different. And as far as helping the most vulnerable, yes, of course. Again, it's a Republican idea. It's a Whig idea to have a safety net for the truly needy. But I don't think that's what Obama, again, means. He's talking about an expansion of the welfare state, which is to pay people not to work, which is to pay people who are able-bodied to help them extend their unemployment to 3 or 4 years, which is a form of welfare, and to not doing anything to actually generate economic opportunity that would reduce that likelihood. I mean, that's, I'm saying that based on the record. In fact, Nancy Pelosi recently said that we should count unemployment benefits as part of employment.
In terms,
they're getting income, yes, of course.
Right.
And just this big government sector and very large sort of what I've heard called the social industrial complex. Millions and millions of professionals paid for by taxpayers to manage people when, in fact, if there was a better economy, more people would be able to manage themselves, and that industry would not be self-perpetrating. So, you know, the words, again, on paper sound good, and they can be looked upon from a conservative standpoint, but that's probably not how Barack Obama means it. Mike?
Well, I agree in the idea of, you know, kind of when you say, or when Obama says that we need to have a free market that is regulated, to use that word, and when we have law and order in the marketplace, one of the things I think you have to consider is who's making the rules, or who is determining the regulations, whether it means how do you affect the stock transfer, how do you decide interstate commerce, all kinds of minutiae. But dependent upon how these rules or regulations are set forth, they can benefit one segment of the economy or the other. And I think that's the key in terms of Congress and in terms of the administration, developing, quote, new rules and regulations to protect the average citizen, if you will, as a great goal. But we have to look underneath and see what kind of regulations are really providing benefits for what segment of the community. You use the idea, an analogy of, say, a football game, and certainly we have rules and regulations in the National Football League about who can do what. But each and every year they'll modify something, and behind it all is a goal to either provide more offense or to regulate defense or whatever, and some are benefited and some are not. So regulation has a great deal behind how it's confined.
Well, I think that, Mike, you're getting at something that is quite profound, in that regulation have consequences, and those consequences can be negative. Every time you create a law and put it out into the firmament, backed by the state, backed by the power of the government, you're going to create, most likely, or in a very good high percentage of times, you're going to create some form of inequality. You're going to dislocate someone from functioning. And this is why some of these laws are necessary. We want to have a society based upon order and law. But they have to be very, very seriously considered, carefully considered. You know, we want to regulate, for example, over pollution because we want to preserve a reasonably clean environment. But at the same time, you have to do it in a way that doesn't contradict our need to help grow our culture, grow our civilization. I mean, you know, we want to continue to develop as a society. We have to feed people. We want to see society grow. So, you know, these are all very complex factors that have to be weighed and measured. And I think when they start talking about moving in for regulation, oftentimes those aspects are not considered, or there's another agenda at foot. You know, there's something else going on. So, you know, we can look at the flowery words and we can be concerned with what is really being proposed here. I think that Barack Obama would like to, in general, shift the country further to the left and to dismantle much of the progress that was made, starting really with Reagan, and, you know, begin to move backwards and sort of more towards something that really never existed in this country before, which is a more European style of functioning. I mean, this is something that, you know, we could go back to the founding republic that we thought we had moved on from. But I suppose it remains to be seen.
Right. You know, if we look, you mentioned Europe, and if we mention, and when you're mentioning that, if we look and see what's happening in Europe and France and Germany these days, yeah, they're trying to sort out kind of the problems that exist and what's going on. And you have people leaving France because, you know, President Holland is you know, looking at huge tax rates and so forth. And so leaders, whether they be in the United States or with President Obama and his administration or Nancy Pelosi, all these people are struggling, trying to figure out how, given the nature of our 21st century and the kind of issues that are involved, what are the best governing principles. And I think we need really good, sound debate and dialogue.
Well, you know, I agree, and I think that so far it appears that President Obama has used the same sort of rhetoric and tactic that the left has used, the same marketing approach, which is to redistribute wealth and confiscate wealth from the successful and give it over to people who are less successful just because they want it. The irony, of course, to that is that the richest people in the world are on the left. It's just a fact. I mean, you can look at it. You can take a look at any of them. I mean, these are not conservatives. And yet, and they're probably not going to participate in this, which is the irony as well. When they start to put in these huge tax increases, they're not going to pay them, and it's going to be paid by the middle class. It's going to be paid by people who are not at that high level. Now, those people have, like the Kennedy family, with due respect to them. Now, all their money has been salted away in these trusts. They don't even get money. I mean, they just, you know, they kind of have everything paid for, whatever they do. They don't, I mean, President Kennedy, for example, he never carried cash. You know, he didn't know from, he never had any. He didn't need it.
Right.
His entire life. I mean, I'm saying that with respect to him.
Right.
Kind of a running gag, I mean, that he would have to always turn to somebody next to him and say, can you give me a couple of bucks, you know, like to put money in the till at church or to do some function. He just never carried cash. Didn't need it.
Mm.
You know, these guys don't have money. I mean, they don't. Their money is all somewhere put away by very sophisticated accountants. It's all properly handled and invested and sheltered. So when Ted Kennedy used to get up on the floor of the Senate and bellow about raising taxes on the rich, you know, it wasn't him that he was talking about.
Didn't affect him at all.
So what happens is that when there's a tax increase, it needs to find a place, and that place is the middle class, not the rich. I mean, Warren Buffett is there bellowing about the fact that he pays less taxes than his secretary based on his income. Yeah, he pays less taxes. He owes $1 billion in back taxes. I mean, sure, he's paying less taxes.
Right, right.
I mean, it's the kind of rhetoric that, I mean, John Kerry, right? He registers his million-dollar yacht in Newport, Rhode Island, so he adheres to charge the Massachusetts luxury tax. They're not going to pay those taxes. Those taxes are going to be paid by John and Jane Q. Public. I mean, the working people of this country, the beleaguered, you know, income earner, the taxpayer. You know, they're the ones that are going to pay these taxes. And they're coming down the pike. They're coming down the pike, and it looks to me like Barack Obama's entire raison d'etre as president, besides the one issue that he was able to get done, which was health care, and we could talk about that separately, his entire fight, his struggle, as it were, his entire movement is toward increasing the debt and then raising taxes. And that's what we always – that's what we're taught. That's what we're given every day. The Boston Globe – you know, every day, how can the president raise taxes here? Can he raise taxes there? Can he do this? You know, it's all about involving and trying to involve the American people in thinking that this is a great debate, this is good, that we give the government even more money. And there's never any discussion about reducing the size of the government, never any discussion about growing the private sector. It's all about how we can get more and more money to the government through either taxes or raising the debt ceilings, like a borrow more money. This is these are seen as great accomplishments. This is the agenda openly, and they applaud when they get it done, you know. And here in Massachusetts, it's the same thing. The Boston Globe is constantly telling us, the governor has found a new revenue stream. I mean,
yeah.
New funds. I mean, I remember Michael Dukakis used to talk about revenue enhancements, right?
I mean, taxes, right.
Yeah, it wasn't enhancing my revenue.
Yeah, right.
It was revenue for the state. And do they really need that much money? I would suggest that we can continue to have all of the social programs and the things that we want to actually help people without giving the government any more money. You know, there are plenty of areas. I mean, you know, Mike, you've been a resident of the state for a long time, as have I. We know that there are plenty of areas in the state where they can cut back on some of the very, very ample benefits and expenditures that they engage in.
Well, there's a reason why people love an authority, whether it be Mayor Menino or anybody else who's been in office for a long time, building up a kind of supply by making appointments to work on the state payroll and so forth. And the ability to have people working for you in state government and looking ahead to a pension, and that's where there's a huge amount of cash, if you will, to people. But if you look at the pension system, you say, gee whiz, if that were modeled after a private pension situation, we would have a great deal of difference in terms of how our state government is run.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a lot of that has to do with public unions, which is another subject that we could talk about separately. But, yeah, I mean, the government has become so corrupt in terms of voting itself these benefits. I remember, and this is a matter of public record, and I'm not trying to single her out because I think that there are a lot of examples of this, but do you remember Senator Cheryl Jakes?
Oh, Cheryl Jakes, sure. State
right.
Senator,
I mean, she ended up getting
activist,
a big job in Washington for the Gay and Lesbian Alliance or something like that. And she arranged the situation such that she left office on a certain day that ensured that she would receive an enormous pension and would receive that pension for the rest of her life, as opposed to leaving the office on another day. I don't remember the details. And again, this is public knowledge, and she's not the only one. I mean, I understand that Senator Paul Scondras did something like this too. It's nothing illegal about it. It's perfectly legal. The problem is that it exists because our government has basically passed these laws to give themselves these gifts.
Right.
So we're going to be paying for her pension while she's off having a big job, probably for the rest of her life. And she was not. She's a fairly young woman.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's going to cost us probably, I don't know, $1.50 a year. I mean, in salary benefits for the rest of her life. What in the world did she do for us that was worth that?
Right. Right. Lifetime pensions. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we have superintendents or people in the education system who retire on a pension at a fairly, if you will, early age, given the state of health and so forth and how long people live. And once they retire on this pension, whether it be 80% or whatever for life, and then if they're able to, they have another job, they're going off to do different things. And again, it's a situation where you can't deal with that way in the public or, I mean, in the private sector. And I think if you go way, way back to a certain point, when salaries for state or public employees were really kind of meager compared to the private sector, then benefits were accorded to state and public employees to kind of equalize the situation. But I think it's now just turned around this different way.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's nothing. I mean, we want to make sure that our public servants are taken care of. There's no question about that. But it's become corrupt. The Boston Herald, for example, a couple of years ago did a front-page piece where they listed, I think it was over 50 people in this state who had retired early and who were getting like over 100 grand a year. And these we're talking about people who retired in their 50s, you know, early 50s in some cases.
Right.
And they could go on to get another job. And we, you know, the people of Massachusetts are going to be paying them, I don't know, $1.50 or $1.25 a year for the rest of their lives. They could live another 30, 40, 50 years. I mean, what in the world did they do? And of course, I mean, you know, I think that every so often the Globe does a spotlight on what they call a double dipper.
Right.
Even the Globe gets its back up on those when you have somebody getting two pensions, three pensions.
Yeah.
So these are corruptions. And so when they talk about building bridges and they talk about infrastructure, they don't mean it in the conventional sense. They're talking about putting more people on the payroll, empowering unions, which is a liberal interest group that also has a lot of pensions and health care. And that's why General Motors went broke. You know, I mean, it was a combination of the union, United Auto Workers, getting salaries of $80 to $100 an hour and getting benefits. If they were laid off, they would get what's called work benefits, which is another way of saying something like 70, 80% of their salary for the rest of their life. That's why General Motors went bankrupt. Plus, you had, you know, CEOs with Lear jets. You know, apparently I'm bringing them up only as an example. They would get together once a year, that being the management and the union bosses, usually at some lavish, swanky resort somewhere where they would have a very well-appointed weekend, and then they would have negotiations once a year for the contract. And basically, the management gave the union everything they wanted, and everybody would have a laugh and shake hands, and every year it would go up in expense. And eventually the country went bankrupt because of the weight of it. I mean, it couldn't sustain it any longer. And, you know, Mitt Romney made a mistake by referring to bankruptcy. You should never have used that word, because General Motors is one of those companies that's it's so intertwined in the American identity that we cannot fathom or tolerate the idea of losing it. But nevertheless, he was correct. He shouldn't have put it that way, in that if they had been forced to reorganize, then the unions would have had to have taken some pretty strong cuts, probably bringing them down to maybe the same level as comparable workers in other automobile companies. And the management would have had a cutback too, and they would have basically figured a way to tighten the belt, to live within their means as a way to avoid bankruptcy, because if they knew they were going to have that, they would have no choice. You know, that's how the system is supposed to work. Rather than having the taxpayers step in and, you know, bail them out and guarantee them and basically hand the company over to this special interest group, that being the United Auto Workers Union. So that's I think, what Barack Obama means by infrastructure. He's not talking about the kind of infrastructure that we would expect to happen. I mean, where you have the building of airports and highways and canals and bridges and things that actually help commerce, both in and of themselves and because they make it easier to do business and to communicate. They're talking about doing it in a way with exorbitant benefits and government involvement. And, I mean, obviously an example here in Boston is the Big Dig, right? I mean, you remember, I'm sure, Mike, when do you remember James Karasiotis, Boohoo Karasiotis?
Oh, yeah, right, yep.
On time and on budget. It was like $3 billion. Here you are 15 years later, and it's $16 billion. And it's not a good tunnel on top of it.
Yeah, we don't want to get into the tunnels, plural, because the new tunnel, and then you've got, you know, the older one, the Callahan Tunnel. Anyway, we build things that are not going to last, but... And that gets into the transportation issues that Deval Patrick, our governor here in the Commonwealth, has talked recently about, you know, rebuilding, doing different things, and looking for money to pay for it, as you say, new revenue streams, and ideas like raising the meal tax, raising the gas tax, raising this tax, et cetera, and even floating an idea that somehow they would determine how many miles you or I drive our automobile in a given year and tax it based upon mileage. How absurd. How absurd.
Well, you know, I mean, I predicted years ago that there was an experiment done in Chicago where they had this ARC built over the highway that would basically pull money out of your account every time you drove under it.
And I
said, you better not tell to Bob Patrick about that.
Yeah, right.
Sure enough, I heard in the news the other day they're installing them.
Yeah.
They're going to be functioning in about a year from now. And they'll put them on different roads to pull money out of your out of the box there. I mean, this is, it's all big government, and it's Big Brother for sure, or Big Sis. And it's, it's just, it's regressive. It hurts business. It's going to drive people out of the state, just like in France. They're moving to England or they're moving to other countries.
Right.
And it's just, I don't think they understand the consequences of that. You know, you have a company that's doing business in Boston, and when they see the cost of living go up for their employees, and they see taxes going up for them, and they see more regulations, you may not see the consequences, but the fact is that they make decisions internally that would maybe mean that they don't expand that year, or they don't build a new wing, or they don't put in a new branch. Or they don't relocate. You know, in other words, they go to other states to do it, and those are unseen consequences to this kind of thing. And if the state is, oh, by the way, if the state's so interested in raising revenues, it's not going to do it. It's not going to work. They would raise more money by leaving the company alone and letting them expand, in which case there would then be more incomes and therefore more state income taxes. I mean, look, my background is kind of a blue-collar background. There was a while where I drove a cab in Boston.
Right.
And one of the things I learned early on was that I could make more money as a cab driver by driving short rides between the hotels in the city and, quick locations than I could if I went out to the airport and I waited an hour or two and got, like, a big ride. I mean, during the same period of time that... took me to get the ride, I would make more money if I did 4, 5, 7, or 8 little rides. And, so there are consequences to decisions.
Right.
And I think that when the state wants to impose more government and more taxes, there are negative consequences to the economy. It's not necessarily seen, but it's there. And, I mean, we can take a look at Greece. It's a... People, the millionaires, basically have left a long time ago, and those are people that we should honor. They're the ones who are creating wealth. They're investing. They are building capital. That leads to more taxes for the government. Reagan understood that. That's why when he lowered taxes, it led to a boom. Same thing with John F. Kennedy.
Right.
So that's how I'm reading into the speech by President Obama, and it remains to be seen how things go. I mean, I think that I don't know. I mean, the Republican Party doesn't seem to be standing up much for its principles at this point. I mean, admittedly, they lost the election, so they have to be the loyal opposition, and they can't expect to get their way. But nevertheless, I'd like to see some more people articulating conservative principles.
Yeah, I think the Republican Party has been lacking the last several years, or maybe even a longer period of time, in people with, again, vision, I'll use the word vision again, and mission, to be able to expound a political and economic policy that does produce results, and to stay the course and to be insistent upon looking at the results of sound policy. And we had that a while back, but I think in these days we're lacking in people with foresight and good ways to articulate. We were hoping for Paul Ryan, but we're still waiting to see how he's going to function in the government. But we do need young people who can articulate an economic vision.
I understand he was booed in Washington during the inauguration. And, Mike, you might recall that on this program, when we were doing it with Patrick, we had a guest on who wrote an article, I think for Huffington Post or some liberal magazine, where they had either interviewed Paul Ryan or they were reporting on an interview of Paul Ryan where he was asked, how can you, as a practicing Catholic, support Republicans when they're being cruel to poor people, when you're against the social safety net? And how can that coincide with your Catholic
of
social justice? And, I personally responded at the time that his views were consistent with social justice. It's just it didn't agree with their particular understanding of what constitutes social justice. But what do you think of that argument, and how does that go over with Catholics?
Well, again, I think you said it quite clearly, is that one can look at the ideas of social justice, taking care of the most vulnerable in our society, caring for the poor, looking at the scriptural admonition to care for one another, to love one another, and to have the same concept of those kinds of principles as a Catholic, as a Christian, as a good Jew, as a good Muslim, no matter. But then how do you translate that, as we said, into action, into works? And what one would interpret as a good piece of legislation, somebody else might say that's going in the wrong direction. And Paul Ryan, among others, have looked at ways in which we're spending money ostensibly for the poor, and it may not be getting there. And so when people like Ryan are trying to take a look and see which programs are effective, which programs are not, and try to fine-tune the ways in which we do try to work for the poor, then because somebody's favorite project is not there, then you have this, quote, unfair criticism.
That's right. And I think that the other response that I've made is that I believe that Ronald Reagan best expressed the principle of social justice when he talked about a social network or social safety net that would help, quote, the truly needy, unquote. And I remember when he said it at the time, there were howls of rage from the left. But that's really what we should be doing, not helping out, not encouraging dependency, not paying for these millions of cadres of people who are there to kind of, you know, conduct and stage manage people's lives. That's not helping the poor. Anything is perpetrating poverty. You know, we need to help private charities like Catholic Charities and Combined Jewish Philanthropies and other groups, both religious and non, who actually do things to help poor people. They're actually getting people, you know, who can be helped out of their predicament. And by doing so, they're improving the dignity of people. You know, they're improving people's respect. They're helping people. We all want it. I think every human being is part of who we are, just like we understand that there is a God, just like we understand that there are inherent rights. I believe that all people have a part of themselves that want to help others, that want to contribute to their society, you know, that are looking for that as a component and an aspect of their meaning in life. And to my way of thinking, the best form of charity and the best form of social justice is to help foster that by giving people, treating people, first of all, as individuals rather than as cogs in a gigantic national wheel, and secondly, by giving people the basic tools that they could then achieve that if possible. There are some people who can't, but even people who can't, I remember when I was teaching guitar, I had a student who lived in a home in Quincy for retarded people, and he would go to work every day doing something that was at his skill level. It was very manual labor, stuffing, you know, pieces of paper and items into boxes. And that man had such joy over going to work. I never saw someone happier to go to work, to get a paycheck, to see other people at that job that he was friendly with. I mean, he felt that he was contributing something to the world. He wasn't just there, you know, on the dole. He wasn't there just sitting home getting a check. You know, he was employed. It made him feel it appealed to a very basic core of his purpose in life, as it does to all of us. It's a very basic element of human nature. We want to do not only we want to do for ourselves, not only to be self-sufficient, but because it does contribute to the greater society. We are contributing to other people. We are involved in building, you know, a community. You know, I mean, as they used to say in Israel, we're building a Jewish state in Palestine.
Mm.
I mean, even if it's picking, even if it's picking oranges, or even if it's shoveling, you know, horse manure, you're building, you know, you have an idea of what you want to do, and you're participating in it. Speaking of Israel, there's a huge election today.
Yes, Netanyahu, yeah.
Is way ahead, and it looks like Israeli Knesset is moving to the right. There's a major turnout for Likud candidates, and there are higher numbers today than there have been in, I think, over 10 years of people getting out to vote. I suspect that it's a reaction to the Obama election. You know, there's concern in Israel
that
Barack Obama is not necessarily as friendly to the state of Israel as have been previous presidents. And I think that this is, in a sense, a statement from the Israeli people that we're going to stand tougher and that we're not going to be pushed into anything that we're not prepared to do. So there's also a young man in Israel named Naftali Bennett, who is a former American Jew who's made what they call, he's made aliyah to Israel. He's also a dot-com millionaire. He's not particularly religious either. He's a secular Jew. But he is, I believe, a candidate for prime minister, and he's generating a lot of excitement. He has said that the Jewish people have a right to live in the West Bank, anywhere, you know, west of the Jordan. He's called for autonomy for Palestinian Arabs, but he has said that it's not realistic for a sovereign state to develop there because it's not in Israel's interest. And he's generating a lot of support, a lot of interest. My only hope is that after this election, if the country has decisively moved to the right, and when I say to the right, I mean that in the Israeli context, you know, in the conventional context, that doesn't lead to a war. It doesn't lead to a reaction by the Arab world to say, oh, okay, well, there's not going to be any, the Israelis are not going to give up land, so we're going to have to start a war. I mean, that's my fear.
Right.
Anyway, so that's what's going on in the news. That and President Obama's inaugural.
And one last thing. I know we're running close to being out of time, but I think we need not forget that yesterday was a day to remember the contributions of Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. And today, January 22, would be the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade and its consequences. And so I think especially for the Catholic Church, there are marches in Washington. I think as we speak during this week, there are many services. So, again, it's interesting how the calendar does provide a focus for how we view each and every day.
I think that what's more interesting about that, Mike, is that I hadn't heard of it. That's what's interesting.
Wow, okay.
You know,
okay.
We obviously hear about the president's inaugural, and we hear about the Reverend Martin Luther King.
Yeah, right.
But that story is not on the radar. And by the way, we could talk about this another day, but Planned Parenthood recently came out with a report. They've made a huge amounts of money, and they're performing more abortions than ever in their history. So that's a statement of where our culture is.
Right.
Michael Wanowitz, I want to thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to do it again.
Excellent. We'll be back next Tuesday, and I shall return, God willing, tomorrow with my friend Blumenfeld. Check out my Amazon Kindle, The Monkey Trial, Evolutionary Politics in the Post-Traditional Age, available on Amazon Kindle, and check it out. Anyways, thanks for listening, everyone. And have a nice afternoon.
Thank you very much.
And thank you to CyberStation USA Radio Network, of course. We shall return.